Yeah, welcome. Thanks. I have to admit, when I got in here, I was really happy that the room wasn't ready because I wasn't either, and that hasn't changed that much. So, at some point, I may have to rely on interactivity. So, please move a little bit closer if you want to. I'm going to nerd out over silly machines because I happen to make them a lot. So who am I? My name is Frank Bredijk. I work at Schuberg Phyllis. I'm a crisis manager at DIVD. And if you ask me about any of these topics, be prepared to be there for a while. So where does this fascination come from? And I honestly can't really tell, but if I look up, my dad was a carpenter. My grandfather was an electrician, but he tinkered with bikes. He built wooden houses. He was always busy. So I got used to things being fixable, things being buildable. And I have, I think I suffer from the misquoted Pippi Langkous syndrome, that I've never done it, so I think I can. I originally trained as storekeeper, store owner, as an administrator, and then found my way into IT. I did my internship on an industrial automation, so all this OT stuff. Yes, I tinkered with Modbus and Biface Mark and serial connections. And at some point, security happened, and I got trained as a CISSP. Don't hold it against me. In this talk, I want to talk. I zeroed in on four machines. I was planning to do three, and then I thought I could do four. I think I can say that I've built software for the world's first 3D color printer, and that was back in the end of the 1990s. I built a certified Aesthetis Harker, a robot that can rake beautifully. I've got the Telex with me in a currently non-operating state, but I'll get to that. And the last project I made was an ASCII photo booth. And I think that's it, but maybe something comes to mind later on. So the world's first 3D printer. That was actually a paid job. I was working for a company called PTS Software at that point in time, which is now part of Alten. And they hired me out to TNO Industry. And if you're a nerd, TNO Industry is a wonderful and horrible place to work. Because I was doing this secret project that was in the back of the Rapid Prototyping Lab, which was a room about this big. And it was filled with 3D printers at the time. So there was a wax printer, there was a paper layer printer, there was a selective laser sintering, there was a stereolithography device. And I had to pass all of them to get to my workstation. And I had to admit, I think the longest it took me was about an hour and a half because these machines are fascinating. You can watch a paper modeler and they slide a bit of paper, they put it down, and then with the laser cutter, they cut it out. They lift it up, bit down, by mesmerizing. Really horrible if you're in a hurry. So this machine actually worked by a principle that a lot of early 3D printers used, and that's selective sintering, not by laser, but by a binding agent. So what they did was they had a plate. You put dust on it. A lot of them used flour. The one we used a very thinly cut plastic. And then you sinter the particles together by selectively spraying sticky fluid on it. Water sometimes worked with flour. You lower the table a bit, just how big you want to have your layers. New layer of dust, new layer of binding agent, lower, rinse and repeat. And when you were done, you would dig into the dirt, grab out your model. And then we had a secret impregnating agent called cyanoacrylate. Super glue. Really super glue it, let it absorb super glue, hards really fast. And you only have to pick it up too soon once. And then you knew why you had to let it dry. Because it was stuck to your fingers. So the selective sintering part of the device, we needed something that could deposit sticky fluids very accurately in a 2D plane. And need to do it with a very high precision. And if you want to do color and you don't want to deposit the granules in a color, but you want to use your binding agent to color, you need to deposit multiple fluids. Anybody, any idea what we used? Bingo. HP inkjet printers. It's that ink is more pricey than gold. I get you not. A gram of ink was more expensive than a gram of gold at that point in time. But it worked really well. So they drilled out one cartridge so that you could fill black with water, because you had to do white, and flour is white, and you don't have white ink. And then we used the other three inks as that. I didn't build the device, but I thought it was a genius move. But 3D color printers. It sounds simple. You have a cube, and it has colors on the front, red. On the back, magenta, green, blue, yellow, cyan. But then the question is, how deep does the color go? And how do you get the crisp edges? Because here's where the red starts, and here's where the... And there it's zero depth. So if you take the simplest form, and I've drawn it in triangles, pardon the drawing, it was late last night, then a cube you can make with about... 6, 12 triangles, you makes a cube. And if you would slice that cube down the middle, you would need a little layer of red and a little layer of green and a little layer of magenta and a little layer of cyan. But how do you build that in a slicer? And if you cut it not straight, but if you cut it down the corner, so if you chop off this little corner here, how does that work? Because then you... And how do you do that? So, any possible ideas how you could do this in software? How could you model this to work? So, one of the things we thought of was voxels. Volume. So, pixel is a picture element. A voxel is a volume element. We ran it around, we started thinking layers that are about 0.5 millimeter thick, models. Wasn't a big printer, it could do this size of models. But yeah, voxels, calculating them. This was in the age of Pentium 2, 1 gigabyte is a lot of memory, Windows 95, Windows 98, and something with high memdotsis. No thank you on the voxels. It's not gonna fly. Any other idea how you would tackle this? Yeah, like I said, triangles. So the models were all in stereolithography files, STLs, still used by a lot of 3D printing projects, although the OBJ files are getting more popular. Essentially, the model was a bunch of triangles. So we used... Binary was used a lot because it kept the file size nice and small. Nowadays, we don't care about file sizes, so we use things as JSON and JAML, and we put it in text files again, but then we wanted binary files. So it's three coordinates you get and a vector. So it's pointing in that direction. These are, and it's... It's designed by the right-hand rule, which means that if you take your right hand and you follow the coordinates in that direction, then that's the front of the triangle. And then there's a unsigned integer of 16 bits where you have an attribute bind count. So they thought about, hey, these triangles can have attributes, and there's going to be a length here, and then there's going to be a block, and nobody used it. So we used those 2 bytes to put 16 bits of RGB information in there, and that gave us a property. But what's the 3D version of a triangle? prism, yeah, trapezoid, prism. I think it's a prism, actually. I'd call it a trapezoid prism. So what we came up with in the end, and that was after a lot of thinking, and this is one of the projects that I actually dreamt of. I got home and then I started dreaming of coordinates. It's really weird, waking up with ideas. So what we did is we took every triangle and extended it inward by the amount the color should go deep. But that's not as simple as it sounds, because the triangles are not just connecting like that, because then it's easy. You can just connect this point down, but they're also connecting like this. And then if I do or like this in a sharp angle, and if I extend this line in a sharp angle, I end up outside of this triangle, and I should never end up outside. So what we came up with is at every point where multiple lines of a triangle met, so basically triangles that share coordinates, you not only had to calculate, you had to calculate the angles that the lines hit each other and then half that angle. Or if it's three lines or four lines hitting each other, you had to find the exact middle to go down. Boy, it was a mess. In the end, we got it working. And then we had to fill, and I forgot to make slides for this, but by the way, all this software, the drivers or the slicer, I would call it now, we wrote it in something that we understood, which was Visual Basic. Yes, I know. I just admitted that I made money writing programs in Visual Basic. I feel old, officially. But the cool thing is it has a canvas tool. So we could make the slice, draw it on the canvas, and then on each triangle, go to the inside of the line and flood fill. The only thing I didn't realize at first was that flood fill tool in Visual Basic 4 only fills out shapes that are drawn in the exact same color that they are originally drawn in. So if you try to fill a shape with black and you've drawn the shape in red, you end up with a black page, which really wasn't nice. So we ended up doing all the slicing twice, once for the outside, draw all the trapezoids, then once again for the inside of all the trapezoids, draw that in black, stitch all those lines together, make sure you don't have holes, fill them in again. That gave you a picture, and then you could print one line. So line thickness, 0.5 millimeter, printing something 10 centimeters high is 100 images you had to render on a Pentium 2 in Visual Basic 4. Like I said, mesmerizing. I had a lot of fun with that project. Any questions on this one before I move over to the next one? Why did I want it? Well, who doesn't want it? Do you have a full color 3D printer? I brought a Bamboo Labs, but it's only like four colors, and it's only now. So this is like 25 years ago. So why did you want it? You want to build this for rapid prototyping. So I want to build a pink flamingo keychain. Sorry. and I want to do it if cool. So if I use a normal 3D printer, I print it in one color, and then I have to give it to somebody who can hold a paintbrush and actually do the colors. And if I do it on the computer and I can get it out straight away in color. The other thing was people were already using inkjet printers to sinter flour to do 3D printing. So the leap, like, hey, they're using an inkjet printer already, let's use a color inkjet printer, wasn't too big. And the biggest manufacturer, we asked them, we got them in a room, we asked, like, you must have thought of this. And their answer was, well, yes, we couldn't get the software to work, which was like, oh, cool. I can apparently do something other people can't. But lots of puzzling, lots of... I think we've spent about 2 months on this project only on the software side. At some point, the printer died, which was another horrible debugging, but somebody else did the hardware, so I didn't get to do that.
Didn't HP
I'm not sure if HP at some point commercialized this. So that was a question. Did HP commercialize it? At some point, my assignment was over. I moved on. But I guess somebody at some point must have either commercialized this or found a better way to do this. But I don't see a lot of color 3D printers around, and I'm actually surprised by that because it is possible.
Yeah, I've seen one, but it was from HP.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
but they quit it already.
Okay, they've also discontinued it. Yeah. Sad. I don't have any pictures of this device because this was 1990s and nowadays we all have cameras with us. But plus it was really classified by then, I guess now 25 years later. So TNO got a patent for this one. And there's a reason why 3D printers took off a couple of years ago, is that was the moment when all patents expired and everybody could start using this technology without actually getting sued or getting in other kinds of trouble, legal trouble at least. So no devices, no pictures, unfortunately, but I thought the story was too cool to leave it out. Moving on to my friend, the certified aesthetic harker. That was actually Elger's idea to do at Hacker Hotel here, certifications for certified CEH. So you could go in one of the rooms here, take a rake, make a beautiful pattern in a mini Zen garden and get a certificate from him. And my robot got one. Somehow I lost it. I think I'd still somewhere in labs at Schuberg Phyllis. But this ID came about because Schuberg Phyllis was building an innovation space. And it was building an innovation space in what was once a warehouse for a clothing company. So it was a horrible room. It was low ceiling, no daylight, horrible acoustics. So in order to fix that, they decided to cut a hole in the roof, put some glass windows down, and make a 5x5 garden in there. And then the idea was, okay, we're going to fill it up with gravel and we're going to have our own Zen garden. Now, I know my colleagues. We work in software because we're intrinsically lazy. We like automating things and raking is fun exactly 0.6 times. So halfway then I would have quit. It's like, I'm not going to do this, so let's automate it. And it turns out somebody already did. So not a very original idea, but somebody already made this thing. And being somebody who'd never built something like this and never wrote software for something like, oh, it's not showing up on that screen. I thought I had to duplicate it. Is it moving somewhere? Yeah. So somebody already built this and... Yeah, the little peepee lunkhouse in me said, I think I can. So made a proposal and the answer was back, well, before you start messing around on the 5x5 scale, build a miniature model. So where's my mouse? Brilliant. I started building my miniature garden. So this is 50 by 50 centimeters. I needed something to put the lines on. I needed some sand. Now, I had never actually done this before. So Gert, you at some point offered that shield. It's like, hey, do you want this? Well, yeah, I can probably use that. I ended up buying some stepper motors, a power supply, cables. And I guess this was near St. Nicholas Day when I started on this one because there's paper note in the screen. And I'd never done this. I didn't know what a stepper motor looked like, but and I never programmed an Arduino. But after some days, I actually got the stepper motors working. Moving at full speed, half speed, quarter speed. 8 speed. So this was my first success. Like, okay, got an Arduino, got programmed a stepper driver. I got a command to send the stepper driver so many steps in so much time. So let's make some spools for the wires. That thing on the bottom here, that was supposed to be my pen. In the end, I ended up using a bit of lead. And then it was a lot of calculating, and I could rely on the lessons I learned with a 3D printer, because I learned already that the Stelling van Pythagoras actually also works in 3D. So A square plus B square is C square, but A square plus B square plus C square is D square. So the length, if you want to calculate the length in 3D. So if I want to position my head somewhere, I need to calculate how long that line is going to be. If I know where I am, I know how many revolutions I need to turn that thing. Need to find out a way to null the device. And thank God, a stepper motor is actually a motor that you can that doesn't suffer if you abuse it. So if you put a stepper motor, if you pull the stepper motor all the way in, at some point it goes, it sounds horrible, but it doesn't hurt the motor. Then if you leave the power off and you start pulling the next one, then it gets pulled, but it doesn't generate any electricity. So it doesn't hurt the electronics behind it. You pull it to the next corner, you pull it to the next corner, and you pull it to the next corner. At some point, you know, I'm on the top left front corner. And then you can start calculating and start moving little things. And the first wobbly steps, and this was supposed to be a square, but the first wobbly steps were there. And then it's a matter of tuning and learning and playing around. And I think you said it earlier today, like changing one thing at a time. So at some point I was at started from the top of the of the poles. And at some point I had too much. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to move it down. And that helped. And little by little, we got improvements. So this is grossly exaggerated. This is a time lapse. But it already looks a lot better. By the way, this looks a lot like a 3D printer. So I used standard G-code to send the thing to somewhere. So I could give it G-code commands, was talking to it with a terminal, playing a file. And then was supposed to go to the next. Later on, and this is at true speed, or lack of speed, I got it even more accurate. But there's still a lot of jiggering in the lines. So what did I learn building this thing? I learned that Arduino programming isn't hard, but you have to understand the constant loop concept. So program by time, go through the loop all the time. There's micro steps in a stepper motor for a reason. So you can let a motor with jumpers, you can set the driver so that it doesn't take full steps, but it takes quarter steps, or I think some even go up to 8th, 16th, or 32nd, 1/32nd of a step. It makes it a lot smoother. But you lose power, you lose speed. Going from A to B in N seconds, and if you have X and Y coordinates, doesn't mean that you can do the difference between X and Y and Z and divide it by 10 seconds, because that sort of gets you in real estate. You really have to calculate where you need to be every single step and then get there. And then you can't do it ahead because there's only so much memory in an Arduino. So it's live calculation over live calculation over live calculation over live calculation. I'm now here. I need to go to there in so many steps. Building something that works is not that hard. But building something that can reliably be used is. So The prototype worked, but building something that we could reliably put in that Zen garden, that everybody could operate it, and my ultimate success would be that if we had a meeting there with a prospect or a customer, that by the end of the meeting, the customer's logo should be in the gravel. Yeah, that's the hard part, because these things tend to go wonk at some point in time and unpredictable intervals. Yeah, lots of math. Like I said, Pythagoras works in 3D as well. Any questions on this one? And I'm not sure if we want to get the throw mic here or if I just repeat the questions, but thank you. Any questions on... Great, you get a mic and then everything is clear. Yeah.
Are you still working on the project, the large format project, or is it something that's in the freezer right now?
At some point, I started to look up that thing and I found it back in pieces because apparently somebody needed stepper motors. That's what you get when you leave stuff in labs. The other thing was, at some point, there was talk about, hey, should we still go this building? Or there was some uncertainty about the prolonged use of that building. And then, yeah, if you know you might be moving out of there, it's not a good time to invest. What's doubtless going to be a bit time. If I wanted to actually build this, I'd probably now go to somebody who builds machines for a living. Explain my concepts and work with them to get it right. But I'm not working on it right now, I'm sad to say. I know I can do it, and it's still, there's still a niche.
I would propose it to maybe the municipality of Amsterdam. Maybe they want to do something like this in a park.
Maybe. Or I was thinking of, I didn't do it, but I was thinking of last time we were at Hackers Camp at Zeewolde, to actually do one on the beach there. That might have been fun, but in the end it didn't happen. And yeah, I've always got something to do. That's a bit of my problem.
See what we can do, Frank.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, you started with the beer thing from Heineken. You got distracted by which you don't have here, but that will be great for next year.
That's the one I missed. Yeah. I'm the one, somehow the one they find when they have weird shit that needs to be done. Moving on to the next weird thing, and that's that Telex, or actually it was another one before, and I don't see Frank Spijkerman around here, but I blame him from making me fall in love with Telexes. Now, I have to be honest, I'm not with this project. I'm standing on the shoulders of some giants. Some of them are here. So Patrick, Gert, who actually did the electronics for me because I suck at electronics. I think I know what it can do, but for me, it works better to explain to somebody what I want and have them do it than do it myself. Also, this Telex over here, it's still a project. It worked at some point. Right now it's broken again. But it also works because, well, at some point on MCH, I was tinkering around with it and somebody comes looking over my shoulder and like, that's a really nice looking one you have. It's like, oh, you work with them for... Yes, I used to be a teletype repairman back in the day. Don't move. Sit over here. Tell me what's wrong with this thing. Turns out that he was the one that learned me that this is apparently a very important knob that I've now touched. So I decalibrated it. This is important because it sets the length of your start bit. And by, I started to understand this thing a lot more. I think MCH, it improved a lot. SHA improved a lot again. But we still had the other Telex that was on stage that you could tweet to. I have to thank Marut and Dens and Bernard from the office, because they helped me a lot with the electronics. If somebody looks at your prints that you've built based on the blueprints of somebody else, and that was FabLab Würzburg, and they go like, I don't know what crack they were smoking when they did this, we can do this better, let them. They could really do it better. So the print now has those orange relays that were on the badge of last year. Ilya made some management tooling for the Pi, and I put it all together and been tenacious. So where did this come from? Well, I got this from a barn in Drenthe. It's amazing the stuff you can find on Marktplaats. And when I got it out, it worked-ish. I was really surprised. I got this thing. It was covered on a layer of dust. I took the dust off. I plugged it in. And it started working. They knew how to build stuff that lasted back then. So this machine's probably dated around the 1950s, 1960s, because it's clearly an East German model. Well, East Germany wasn't there before 1945, so it's past 1945. And telexes are amazing. They were our first true, well, digital communication. Okay, Morse code, there's other telegraphs. But they revolutionized how we could communicate with other parts of the world. They used binary communication, 5 bits. And it's actually so similar to serial protocols these days that you only actually have to convince serial protocols to do two things. Not work on voltage, because a lot of interfaces work on voltage. I have a voltage, I don't have a voltage, and you measure if there's a voltage. Well, this works on current. It's 40 volts, it's 40 milliamp. Yes, it hurts. Niet aanlikken. Don't touch either. At some point, I was making some modifications, and then sometimes you go, yeah, okay. But five bits, which gives you 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 characters. But you have 26 in the alphabet, then you got 10 numbers, 36, then you got a number of punctuation marks, you run out of table space really quickly. And what they did was really clever. They introduced two special characters, the 11111 and the 11011, and that does a mode shift. So when it gets 11111, it knows that it has to shift two letters, and it literally shifts two letters. The carriage goes up or down, depending on where on the hammer the letters are. And if it gets 11011, carriage drops, goes back to number mode. Clever system, which is also why you see a lot of telex messages start on the punch card with a lot of holes punched, because they had the habit, like, I need to make sure this thing is in letter mode. So letter, 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 and start typing your message. 1.5 start bit, 5 data bits, 1 stop bit, 50 bits per second. Whopping 50 bits per second. You're complaining if you don't get 5 gigabit at home. 5 bits per second, 50 bits per second, which gives you about 7.5 bits per character. You need to do some shifting. This thing could do a whopping 6.6 characters per second. And that's still fast. If I'm really typing fast, I run into the blockages that this thing gives, but usually it works. And it was the first time you could send letters across the pond. 40 volts, 40 milliamps is really a nice oomph to it. So you can run this thing over barbed wire from one war zone to the other, and make the barbed wire a little bit more effective in the meantime as well. Also, if you have too much resistance, you just crank up the voltage a little bit so that you get your 40 milliamps, as long as you get your 40 milliamps. The whole thing is electromechanical. So it transfers characters from one side to the other. Like I said, I'm standing on the shoulders of a giant. Somebody made software before. And the board. They documented it. Ish. Yes. We had some finding out to do. At some point, this thing wouldn't receive. Turns out that on the back of this board, there's a jumper. Couldn't we send? What was it? We couldn't send or we couldn't receive?
I think we couldn't send.
We couldn't send.
2 days to find it.
Yeah, 2 days to find that there's a little jumper that needs to be closed if you want to be able to send something. And it was undocumented, obviously. The other thing is that it took me a really long while to realize that the current regulator that's on this board is actually what is used to send the signal. So you actually say the current regulator, give me 40 milliamps, give me 0 milliamps, give me 40 milliamps, give me 0 milliamps. So that was interesting. Got this working, and the first modification I did to it was to hook it up to Twitter. Now, those of you that been to MCH, maybe seen this thing around, you could actually send tweets from the Telex. You could send tweets to the Telex. At some point, we had it on stage where you could request what number the band should play through the Telex. And I've actually kept an archive of everything that was sent, including links to the tweets on GitHub. Here's the link. But yeah, at some point, the Twitter API stopped being free. And giving, and I'm not giving this guy any money. So the second modification was to put it onto Telegram and onto Slack, because we in the office we use Slack, and Telegram is known here, but not really to the business types. And Telegram bots are easy to write. Turns out that the Pi Telex software was built up as a current loop as well. So like the whole Telex network works. And what it does, it's like you have a loop, and everything you type on one Telex is received by the other. And everything you type on the other is received by this one. And actually, this machine already is two Telexes in one. So this is a Telex, but it's a sending Telex. This is a receiving Telex, and they're in a current loop. So everything you type on the keyboard gets printed on the printer. But it turns out that if you put a Twitter bot and a Telegram bot and a Slack bot in the same loop, then everything that's tweeted to the Telex gets sent on Telegram, gets sent on Slack, and then everything that gets sent on Slack. And it got messy really quickly. So I ended up loosely coupling it, writing a TCP connector where I could say, okay, this is a TCP port, and then everything that gets sent on the Telex side gets blurted out on the socket, and everything that gets sent to the socket gets blurted out on the Telex, and it's not in the loop anymore. So that was my third contribution to the software. I also made a watch guard, because this thing makes a ruckus when it's on. It's really an old fashion motor whining, lots of gears making lots of noise, and then there's hammers hitting paper, and this thing is kinetic. And my colleagues in labs weren't prepared to sit in its noise all day. So I made a watch guard, a little program that basically on a Pi, if you connect to a TCP socket, it starts a timer, opens up a relay, so that this thing powers on, can do its trick, and then if nothing is typed for a minute, then or 5 minutes, it powers down again to give a little bit of sanity. When you're debugging these things, slow-mo cameras are a really awesome tool. You can see the little rotational going down, and then unfortunately, in slow-mo, it takes forever. And then you see five little hammers, and that's the signal being sent. And it's going to happen any minute now. So that was a 01010. And then a little bit later, you saw the hammer going. It's really awesome. To me. Another one where you actually see so how the signal is sent. So you have the current loop, and you see that it goes by really quickly. But what you actually see is this is a coil, and it's actually two coils. One is one that has a permanent, that's on all the time. And the other one is only on when one is being sent. So all those little pins are being dropped, and then one by one, they're being pulled up close to the magnet. And if there's power on the second coil, it gets pulled up. And because there's that permanent magnet there as well, it sticks. If there is a zero, if there's no power, it gets pulled up, drops down again, and it doesn't stick. And that means that you get a combination of a five-bit unique combination. These little pins are connected to combs. And I should have made a diagram of this, but I was getting tired. And if you have the fine combs aligned in a certain way, then at one position, everything... there's a hole in one position. A little lever drops. And then a hammer comes, whacks the little lever. That little lever is connected to a little hammer. Little hammer hits the block. That's how they manage to take the five bits and turn them back into a letter on paper. No memory, no CPU, purely electromechanical awesomeness. And temperamental. Yeah, another one. I'm going to spare you this one. So, any questions on this project? And I need a little bit of inspiration. What's fun to learn?
Can you, hello? Yeah. Can you play the video while we do the questions?
Oh, sure. Legitimize me. This is we were debugging a shift problem. So this is the little part where the wagon goes up and down, and and the audio in it is really wacky as well, but I guess you turned it down and that's okay. I've not plugged the audio in. Ah, okay. Thanks for the tip. I'll do it next time. there it went. It's like, yeah. And it's up and it's not going up properly. Turns out there was a little jump thingy on an axis back there that was getting a little bit, was losing its tension. So it was spring losing its tension and it needed to be unscrewed, put a little bit more to the front or to the right and then screwed back on. But there's like a gazillion parts on that thing. Any other questions?
I have an actual question too. Is there any chance we're going to see it working this weekend?
So it works kind of. I spent two hacker hotels in the hacker space, and I actually promised myself that I would watch more talks than I would give this time. Let's see. Let's see what happens. These kind of events are usually good for it. But we can turn it on. It actually can run standalone, but not really good with the other. And there's an issue with... Right now, if you hit the space bar too much, you type too many characters, at some point the carriage returns without actually getting a carriage return. Awesome fun fact, carriage return and line feed literally is what it says, feeding the paper line and returning the carriage to its home position. And it's an actual carriage that runs on rails. I see if you can throw it to Kato.
Hey, thanks. Did you study the typewriters? Because I used to learn how to type on a typewriter.
So yeah, me too. I'm also that old. Sorry.
No, but everything that you are describing is like the manual labor you do on a typewriter. But for a big part, made mechanical.
Yes and no. So it has similarities to a typewriter, but to a typewriter, especially the mechanical ones, it was you whacking that little hammer, yes. And now it's a wheel. So knowing how a typewriter works helps, but only so much, because it doesn't have that whole electro part, and an electrical typewriter works differently. Because then you just have a switch, and that switch selects which hammer goes.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Chris.
Thank you. Actually, you just disclosed a vulnerability, a kind of denial of service attack on Telex. So are these vulnerabilities disclosed in some way or another?
Ooh.
Is there a CNA for Telexes?
I think somebody described the laws of nature, yeah? Now, this is physical. This physical laws. So it's the limitations are just physics.
Yeah, but some combinations of signs can, you know, slow it down or either... You know, that it doesn't work anymore. So what are the most severe vulnerabilities you found?
Man in the middle.
I've actually... Well, it's definitely man in the middle, because this thing is so got a lot of wire speeds. I think they weren't considered... They didn't consider it yet. And all security was done by cryptology. So by actually obfuscating the message that you were sending instead of any security in this, it were physical lines. The only good thing about this one is if somebody's snooping, at some point the line will drop. So at some point that machine will go and get... So the start bit is zero, and then it will get all zeros. And that's usually also a control character, so the whole thing will go... Dum, 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 dum. It's really fun if you disconnect it and turn it on. It's like lots of violence. Vulnerabilities... I've not found any combination that you can really make it do weird stuff other than... you can type a line that's longer than 80 characters. And then it's up to the receiving end to handle this. So this thing has a little knob that if you hit it, it will automatically do a carriage return and line feed and go back to the start. I'm not actually aware of any CVEs awarded for Telexes yet.
Maybe you should register one. Anyone?
Yeah, I can.
Hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll feel so millennial with this, but what exactly is a telex?
So this. Thank you. Do you know what a typewriter is?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Imagine two typewriters magically connected with a bit of wire. So first of all, this is a telex. So imagine two typewriters that are magically connected by two bits of conductive material, and everything you type on the one goes out on the other. And now I could make the mistake of saying it's like the early version of the fax, which may get the result back like what's a fax. but before telephone messages, before the earliest communication was by telegraph, which was like Morse code on a wire. Then at some point they wanted something more sophisticated, something easier to operate. And then you got telex, where you could send binary messages with letters and numbers. Typewriter, where you type something on a line. Ultimately, you get this, and the cool thing is that with this, so the way I sold it, that I could work on this on work time, and you're a colleague of mine, is like, look, this is an awesome testament of how we can integrate these things, because we can integrate something from the 60s with artificial intelligence, because at some point I hooked it up to ChatGPT, and I should have addressed that part, to ChatGPT, and we're integrating something from the 2020s with something from the 1960s. So that's 60 years of technology apart. If you doubt we can integrate stuff, please leave. By the way, funny story. Is that enough of an explanation? And otherwise, we'll get there. Any more millennials? Yeah. no. So two short things on the ChatGPT. I created a character by prompting ChatGPT. So the character is called Fern. He's a Fernschreiber operator in the German Democratic Republics in the 60s. Drops the occasional German word in, knows a few Eastern German jokes. I taught it more, and at some point it caught on that it's not actually a fan of the system. So if I fed it too many Eastern Germany jokes, it would not respond back that communism was the next best thing since sliced bread, which was really like, okay, this is how that thing works. It really sort of, it seemed to pick up the context of the humor. So I definitely hope to get it back at Hacker Hotel next year where it's actually working and you get to talk to Fern. The last machine I brought, and I just got told I got 5 minutes for that. So that's this thing here, which is the fault of Marieke, who's not here yet. And Chris, for DIVD, we had a partner day and Marieke really wanted a photo booth. With silly hats, mustaches, and I cringed. And then Chris said, yeah, like, I found this website where you can convert a picture to ASCII art. Do you know what ASCII art is? Cool. And then I was like, okay, the little Pippi Longstrom for me said, like, I can do that. I can make a photo booth that actually gets you a picture in ASCII and print it out on a matrix printer. So got a matrix printer, got a Raspberry Pi, Pi Cam on it, wrote an application in Flask that streamed the image, and then if you hit a button, it gets captured. Put a tablet, I think the first one, I actually put a laptop there, now it's got a tablet there. Put an access point here because I don't trust the local Wi-Fi. And then I wrote 3 Linux services, the HTTP server, which does all the user interaction, the print.py, so if it takes a picture, it drops it in the queue. Print.py takes the JPEG, converts it to ASCII using a program that's already exists for that, so I didn't have to write that. I'm lazy. And then it puts it in the queue, prints it, and then if you put your email there, it also creates another file, and there's the send email process that that sends the email to you. In the process, I learned that matrix printers can be really expensive. Unless you buy them on Marktplaats, then it wasn't too bad. I was really happy that it actually had a USB port, because that saved a lot of hassle. But then Ilya, a colleague of ours, bought one which has a parallel port and a parallel to serial to USB converter. We'll fix it. I also learned that I can be part of the problem because I had a data leak in this thing twice. You need to tell your web form that your results shouldn't be cached, and then if you're using a tablet, you need to tell the keyboard not to cache the results as well. So everybody's email was, when they typed, they got other people's emails as suggestions. Thanks, Tabitha, for pointing that one out. It's fixed now. I didn't register CVE for that one. So that was my story on this one. I survived this first talk. Thank you for your attention. I think we got 1 minute for a final question. 4 minutes for final questions. And who has got the mic?
In the character set of the Telex thingy,
yeah,
there was a "Who are you?" character.
Yes, yeah.
What is the purpose?
So in the communication, you could send a, in later versions, you could send a "who are you" command, and then the telex would actually auto-reply with its identity. And that identity, there's a little wheel here, and mine's still completely intact, but you can actually break off parts to give it zeros and ones. So if this thing starts spinning, it automatically puts a number of characters on the line. So if you did the "who are you," then the other telex on the other side would respond back with this identity. If you had 3 telexes in the loop, it would get messy. Also, you could send back then the "who are you," and you would get the identity back. And that was a way to verify the identity of the parties communicating. But it's still a system built on trust. It would not stand today's scrutiny. Spoofing vulnerability. Yeah. Any other questions? In the back.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah.
What other devices would you like to hack in the future?
Now he triggered me. I want to build a big one. So I learned that there's this thing that draws pictures with the cylindrical one. So it's an old communication one as well. And that one is awesome. I forgot what it's called now. But usually inspiration just just hits me. It's like remarks like that, photo booth, we can build something, and then something in my mind goes, but we can do both, and that happens at odd intervals, at odd reasons. Maybe.
Running on a space shuttle computer.
Yeah. You had a question, Gaspar, or not? I thought, take the mic, then they can hear you on the recording as well.
About the 40 volts, 40 milliamps, was that chosen specifically for like the distances at that time, where they like the bipolar thing, military purposes, stuff like that?
You need a certain amount of oomph to do the mechanical things. And to be honest, this thing has run on, if you look at the manual, it's like it says like aim for 40 volts, 40 milliamps. Upper boundary causes you to lose magic smoke. Bottom boundary, then your messages don't arrive. And I think the first time I got Hugo's power supply, which wouldn't go up above 36 volts. And yeah, so 40 volt, it's a convention, and I'm not sure why. I think it was just like, oh, I need to get a certain distance, and I could get a certain, and you need a certain amount of energy to actually do the mechanical part.
Okay.
Does it also mean that you can blow up the other end from here?
It's an electromagnet. What do you think? At some point, if you put enough energy through it, it will get hot. It will start smoking and destroy itself. Yeah. Yeah, it literally is one circuit. So also the other thing is you have to agree with the other party who's going to put the current on the line. Because if you both do, you're going to end up with double the amount of current.
Yeah.
And that was it in terms of time. Thank you very much for your attention.